we were looking at the space of solutions of of black hole solutions of the Einstein's equation. So this is the subset of solutions that we were interested in, and these are characterized by this Penrose diagram. I will not go through all the details again, but just the main pieces. We have an horizon, a bifurcation surface, C. Then we have an asymptotic region at infinity, which is Minkowski plus corrections. And we chose a surface sigma that starts at the bifurcation surface and ends at the constant radius sphere at infinity. So this is the setup in spacetime. And we are considering, and all these solutions have one special Killing vector field, which is the combination of two Killing vector fields. And it's special because at the horizon, it becomes normal to the horizon. So this is thus making the horizon a Killing horizon. It decomposes into a sum of two other Killing vector fields with a constant coefficient, because otherwise this wouldn't be Killing itself. And this constant coefficient, constant on spacetime, is called the horizon angular velocity. The two Killing vector fields have the interpretation of time translation and rotations once we are at infinity. For example, inside the black hole region, inside the horizon, time translations, this Killing vector field becomes space-like, so it's definitely not a time translation in this region. So in the case of Schwarzschild, where we can neglect. So chi has also these nice properties at the bifurcation surface. It vanishes there. And in fact, and its derivative, it's given by the bivector normal to C times a constant, which is the surface gravity. The fact that it's constant is a statement of the zero. Okay, so this is all about the spacetime. Now we move on to field space, and we look at, we're interested in the charges associated to this spacetime and see how they vary between neighboring solutions. So it's like an ensemble picture of thermodynamics where we have many equilibrium configurations, and we look at how what happens if we move from one to the other one next to it. So it's not a dynamical change, it's an ensemble picture. So the general covariant Hamiltonian flow equation that we have takes this form on shell of the equations of motion. There is not for diffeomorphisms. So remember, this is a consequence of diffeomorphic symmetry, this formula, especially this extra term over here. And now we have to compute these, and we can use all the properties that we have collected here. In particular, what do we have? We have that since chi is a Killing vector field, its variation of the metric is zero, so rho of chi is zero. So these are isometries. This term just drops. Then let's look at Q. On shell, we know that since we are dealing with the local symmetry, it becomes a pure boundary term. So we will only have to worry about what happens at C and S, no details about sigma matters actually. So what is this boundary? Well, it is the bifurcation surface together with the sphere at infinity. And the main properties that we're going to use is that chi vanishes here. We will use this property. And at infinity, we will use that phi is tangent to S, and therefore will drop from this term. One last thing that I claimed and didn't prove, saying it's a computation one can check. The computation is in Wald's original paper. He shows that we say that phi drops, so we just have to worry about t. For time translations at infinity with all these special boundary conditions, what happens is that this quantity is a total variation of the ADM mass. The fact that this is a total variation is not a general fact. It just happens thanks to our boundary conditions and the choice of this special vector field. So we see that this will become a correction to the charge. So now that is exact, is a delta of something, we can reabsorb it into Q. So let's now go and compute Q. We have, I brought Q at C at the bifurcation surface to the left. And on the right, we have this term, the variation of half of the variation of the ADM mass. And then we have the two terms coming from Q at infinity. Each piece is due to T. Now, remember, Q depends on the metric, so we cannot bring it in the variation. So this is why I wrote things like this, with chi outside. In Young-Mills, in the tutorial, there was a question about this. I don't know if you got there because I had to leave, but anyway, this is what happens in general. And this is the reason why, for example, omega is outside of the variation. Even though it differs from black hole to black hole, it's outside this variation because that's what the right interpretation of this formula tells us to do. Now, however, T and phi at infinity, only at infinity, they are the same for all solutions because at infinity, this is just Minkowski. So it turns out, therefore, that it is correct to bring them in. And so this simplifies our computations because we can just look at what the Komar charge, so this Q infinity of T is, and the Komar charge of phi is at infinity. And these are the angular momentum and half of the ADM mass. There is this funny sign and one half mismatch between the Komar charge of time translations with the ADM mass. But this is exactly what we need to compensate, to complete, in a sense, this formula to be the variation of the ADM mass minus omega, the variation of the angular momentum. We're only left to compute what happens on the left-hand side. So at infinity, the asymptotic structure gives us a notion of energy and angular momentum. And now at the horizon, we will find the remaining piece, which is the entropy, in a sense, the entropy. Of course, we will not find an entropy. We will find a geometric quantity, which is the area times the not the temperature, but the surface gravity. So it is super easy to see that using this formula, where is it? This formula over here, and the Komar charge, the expression of the Komar charge, one immediately sees that Q the Komar charge at the bifurcation surface of our Killing vector field is kappa times the area. This is just you plug in this into this formula here, and this is what comes out. However, as I said multiple times, we cannot take the variation of this because chi sits outside the variation. So what this means is that we first need to vary this formula for some fixed psi. So we're varying essentially the metric inside these derivatives in the fact that it's lowering this index and whatever volume element this encodes. All these things depend on the metric. And only at the end, we can evaluate this expression at chi. We had done most of that calculation last time, and we were left with this expression here. Kappa came out because of the zero law, and the way it comes out is, again, through this formula. And now I just want to quickly show how these things, how to finish. So we noticed that, in particular, this variation, this piece is simple to see. It's just the variation of that times these. These we evaluated chi, which gives us kappa epsilon. And so it's just this. Here there is a factor of 1/4, maybe. I would need to think. So, but there is a numerical factor. So here, on the other hand, it comes from the variation of the metric used to lower these indices. And once that's taken into account, and one uses the fact that chi vanishes at c, the only thing that survives is such a term. Now we can combine these two terms. If you look at it for a second, you will see that this is epsilon of a, essentially, maybe I should rename this quickly, like this. So this becomes AB, with the indices 1 up and 1 down. And because I can write these, of course, put a G here to lower and this index. So this becomes kappa half C epsilon AB D of epsilon AB. So here we're essentially done, because we need to remember that this epsilon like this is nothing else than the volume element on C. So we call it the volume element on C times the binormal. So this evaluated at C is nothing else than volume element of C times binormal. Volume element of C. And so we are left with the following: kappa half C epsilon AB epsilon AB and the volume element. I claim that I can take this out of the integral. Why? Because epsilon AB is minus 2. Now, don't quote me on the signs. I'm not really sure where I left them, but it's 2, okay, up to a sign. And also, because of the special position of the indices, there's no metric involved in this contraction. So what happens is that if I take D of these, this is 0, but it's also twice epsilon AB D epsilon AB. Because since it's anti-symmetric, it doesn't really matter the order in which I write them, and there is no metric involved. So if I can write these only because the indices are 1 up and 1 down, and this is special also to 4 dimensions. I'm not sure how this computation would work in a different dimension. Because if the horizon were one dimensional, this would need to be 1 down and 1 up, because I have only one index. And then there is a metric involved in contracting them. Whereas here, magically, it's just twice epsilon of that variation. So this vanishes, and this becomes just kappa up to a sign C of the variation of my volume element, which is kappa the variation of the area, which is exactly what I wanted. Right. So we were really close to finishing last time, but so putting things together, we find the first law of Black hole mechanics, which is kappa dAc dm minus n what gives the title to Walt's paper is his discovery that essentially the neutral charge you see is equal to what in this formula takes the interpretation of the entropy times. So this is the second result. And this allows him to give ansatz about what happens in for higher derivative theories in different in different situations, essentially, because then this doesn't depend on the details of the dynamics. There is an abstract way of finding it without having to redo everything from scratch. So it allows you to bypass. It's not necessarily you have to check that is the right answer in the end, but it allows you to have something to work with. Okay.
Ando,
yeah.
This area is it's an area of surface of bifurcation.
Yeah.
Right? But it should be the black hole surface.
So yeah, it is the same thing. So, because since, so the situation here is that this spacetime is static, or is stationary. So the area of the horizon doesn't change in time. So it doesn't matter where you compute it. And it's useful to use this this surface has extra nice properties. So you use that as the place to compute it. So yeah, remember, the idea here physically was to look at the final state of the black hole. And this diagram is kind of a special. It's a maximally extended version of that late time spacetime. So you evolve it backwards using stationarity, and that's what you. Okay, so this concludes the chapter. I think what is nice about this derivation is that it really shows what is the role of the symmetries of the theory in this formula. So this thermodynamic looking formula is here really tied in a very strong way to the Hamiltonian flow equation, and so the symmetries of the diffeomorphic symmetry of general relativity. And also these facts. This is just the most famous formula of this kind, but these days researchers are really pushing hard on the covariant field space formulas to try and study the thermodynamics of null surfaces, like where by thermodynamics one means expressions like these, and trying to understand what the pieces are, and one can try to relate these to holography and the fluid fluid dynamics and so, but that's a whole world. So this is probably the first applications where one uses the covariant phase space method to derive this kind of relationship. Now it's a big industry. This was the pioneering calculation. Okay, so I would like today to show how one can start from the covariant field space and from that construct the canonical phase space. So what we did is not something else. It's like a way to get the usual phase space of any field theory. And in fact, if you want, it shows exactly how these things hold together. And so if I'm happy to take another question about that. But otherwise, we can. Space. So I've said many times that the covariant phase space is not the real phase space. It's you have these weird objects that are reminiscent of a symplectic form and a phase space, but they're not quite. So here we will see exactly how to relate the two. So the first and main result that these correspondences is based on is this theorem that we proved very early on, that on shell, the covariant symplectic structure is conserved. So from this, we deduce that, and I will make a drawing in a second, that on shell, omega integrating over a Cauchy surface is independent. Sorry, not equal to zero. I wanted to say is independent of sigma, as long as sigma has no boundaries. So the picture here is my usual pair of potatoes spacetimes, well, space slices, sigma, m. We have a normal, and m is sigma cross r with sigma equal to, okay. So this is the picture behind these results, this result here. And the main point is that here I put equal to zero, but what I meant was on shell is independent of sigma, because this equality holds only on shell. So from that, we argued that we can understand the space of on-shell configurations, of on-shell histories, together with omega sigma, or some sigma, to be our phase space. It has all the right properties of a phase space, in a sense. The issue is that is a very implicit description. It is kind of hard to work with, the space of on-shell histories. But what is that? So today we want to make this a bit more concrete. I will proceed by using examples rather than trying to make an abstract theory. And so this example will get more and more complicated. So let's start from the simple one. Scalar field theory. I could do the example zero would be the word line theory of the particle seen as a one-dimensional field theory, but it works essentially like the scalar field. So I will not, one doesn't really gain much by doing that. So here, let's remember our Lagrangian is given by 1/2 of square root of g, dA phi, dA phi. And then let me just say plus, etc. Here could be a mass term, a potential, but no derivatives. Okay? So here is, let's put it, it doesn't cost much. Something like that. And now from this, theta, which depends only on the kinetic term, will be what? Will be roughly, the rule of thumb is one replaces one of the derivatives with a so you're integrating by parts, right? So that's theta. Let me write it, it's easier, with the variation. One replace one of the derivatives with the variation. So this is square root g, dA phi, d phi. Or in form language, one could write dA phi, d phi, and here, epsilon a. Same thing. Okay, so this is a top minus one form, or a current. Oh, sometimes I didn't put this square root of g in the formula for theta, so that is not a density, but a current. But it's just the convention. Okay, so from this we compute theta, omega over sigma, which, remember, is the integral over sigma of d theta. So this is square root of g and a dA phi. Sorry, there should be a d phi, right? If this goes. Does it make sense? So now, so this is on sigma. So what is this guy? Well, I like to write these. So the here the metric and the normal are kinematical quantities. They're not part of my field space. So this variation can go inside or outside. It doesn't really matter. So it's nice to think of these as phi dot, right? Is the time, is the derivative of phi in the direction normal to my surface, to my upper surface. So it's like a time derivative of that scalar field. So this is the velocity of the scalar field. And here we have the scalar field. Of course, this looks a lot like d pi wedge d phi, right? So why is that exactly the right thing to think in those terms? Well, from the perspective of sigma, whatever this means in mathematical terms, but let's be a bit intuitive, that the normal derivative of phi, so this phi dot, which is nothing else than the normal derivative of phi, is completely independent of phi itself. So in fact, it's a new, from the perspective of phi, I can compute the derivative along phi, but I cannot compute the normal derivative. So this is really a new field. And in fact, it is best interpreted as a new field on sigma. So what do I want to call it? I want to call it pi. It's convenient to include square root of g in there, so that we find a canonical situation where we have delta pi, delta phi. So we introduce pi to be square root of g pi dot. And we define our phase space. Well, maybe I go here. We define our off shell phase space as follow. The off is the set of pairs pi phi, where phi, so phi now, sorry, I should have written it completely independent of, shouldn't have written phi here like this. I should have written, and I apologize, of phi defined as pi restricted to sigma. So this is the entire point. is not independent of curly phi, which is defined on spacetime, but with respect to phi defined on sigma itself, it is independent. So this here, this is what I mean by the straight phi. And omega off is just d pi wedge d phi. So is there any question about this procedure? It's a bit heuristic, but one can make it rigorous by essentially one needs to clarify exactly what one means by that, but it's just mathematics, but doesn't add anything to the intuition of. Yes?
Can you just repeat why you mentioned that it's not independent of phi, but it's independent of phi star?
Yeah, so this phi, this curly phi, is defined everywhere on spacetime, so I can derive it in all directions I want. But phi, the restriction of my field to the surface, now I can only derive it along the surface. Doesn't make any sense. Like, it doesn't know about M. It just lives on sigma. So from this straight phi perspective, this normal derivative is just doesn't exist. Yeah. So I need to give this extra piece of datum to it, like to the phase space. So I can rewrite this in that form, but now it's defined on a different field space. So where pi, let's actually write what pi is a weight one density on sigma. Weight one, it just means that it's multiplied by square root of, well, I should have put square root of h. It's basically the same, well, sorry, this was h, on sigma. And phi is just a function, is a, on sigma. So this is my off-shell phase space, and is defined by these two quantities. Now, why I call it off-shell? Because I haven't worried about the equations of motion yet. But we know that the actual phase space is on shell of the, is essentially this guy on shell of the equations of motion. However, we have a remark in this case, which makes our life easier. For every value of phi at sigma equal phi, for every pi phi, there is one and only one solution to the equations of motion such that pi and pi are the initial conditions, essentially. So now so here I went one way. Now I'm trying to reverse engineer. So at sigma is equal to phi, and dn and square root of h, dn of phi at sigma is equal to pi. So this means that pi off, in this case, is isomorphic to the space of on-shell solutions. I have a map. It's just the initial condition, the attribute, like these. I represent each solution by its initial condition on sigma, and this gives me p off. So in this case, p off and p on coincide. So
but the reason that you call it off-shell is there is no constraint in sigma, right?
Exactly. So in Young-Mills, it will be a different story. And that's the next point. I don't need to distinguish for the scalar field P off, omega off, from P omega, which is the one that I would like to call, which is the on-shell version of it. So in this case, it's easy, and we see that the usual procedure of understanding phase spaces as these restrictions to the boundary essentially just works fine and gives me immediately the right answer. Now, if this is clear, we move on to Yang-Mills, where the situation is more subtle because, as Amir said, we have constraints. And this was part of the tutorial in a sense, no? So case two. Before I go here, are there questions before we make things more complicated?
So the map you are saying, how do we see that there is only one solution?
Well, you're right. I didn't prove it. Here we have an hyperbolic equation of motion. And the theory of hyperbolic equations of motion, unless it's particularly ill-defined due to a crazy potential, it tells you that each solution is you can solve
so any
for phi in space-time.
Any degree equation means usually if it's a second order equation, you get two solutions and stuff like that. So
yeah. So here is basically that statement. It's a bit vague. I'm not depends on the details of the equations of motion, but if you have a second order equations of motion, you expect that the initial position and velocity completely determine the solution. So yeah, this step rigorously can be actually quite tricky.
But then we have to distinguish it from Yang-Mills. This is a key step, right? We are saying there is a one-to-one map,
mm-hmm.
So we can identify the off-shell with on-shell.
Yeah.
And that will not happen in Yang-Mills.
Yeah. So the scalar field or the particle, so the usual idea that we have of phase space, I would say, is based on this example, where your initial position and momentum. You just say, oh, this is phase space. But in fact, the way everything works so neatly is because of this correspondence. Now we will see that one has to be careful in Yang-Mills to distinguish between the two. And in gravity, we will have the same, but even with a bit more complication. So in Yang-Mills, now you know this by heart. And field space F is the space of one forms on space-time valued, let's say, in SU2. And one point there is this A, right? So you've calculated these in all possible sources, so I will not go into. But if you don't remember something, just ask. But I will go a bit faster since we have already seen this. So theta is star f wedge the variation of a, and this can also be written in components as the trace b e a b. So maybe without this, and I put the epsilon on this side. Okay, so the star is contracting indices, and in that way. Now omega. So let's see. So omega on sigma is therefore, again, I write it in two ways in form language. And. So I want to write it like this without unpacking f, and we will see in a second why. And this is also equal to sigma square root of h and a trace of f a b e So to make things a bit more concrete, let me use as an example Minkowski, where everything is square and I can not worry too much about derivatives if they are covariant, not covariant, etc. So in Minkowski, where M is R3 cross R, what do we get here? Omega sigma is equal to, well, square root is basically not there. So this is over R3 of the trace of F0i di. So a few remarks. First remark, sorry, there is an extra D. An extra variation here. Oh, and here as well. Sorry, I'm losing pieces. First remark. A0 only appears inside F. Okay, fact of life. This is related to the fact that the phase space is just contains the AI and not A0. A0, if you do the usual Hamiltonian analysis, a Lagrange multiplier, but here, in fact, we don't even have to do that. It comes out alone by itself. A0 is not part of phase space. Two, let's look at what this F0i is. So this is D0 AI, which is essentially AI dot, minus the other terms repackaged in this nice form is the covariant derivative with respect to AI of A0. It's not too hard to see because you have the derivative di A0 and then the A wedge A, which is A. So gives this. Okay, so essentially this is the analog of this normal derivative that we had before, but it's embellished by this extra piece. So this is the analog of dn phi embellished by or with, I'm not sure, di A0. But as a package, this is a new object which is independent from the perspective of sigma from AI, the whole package. From perspective of sigma, the entire package is an independent field with respect to AI. So maybe I should call it small AI, just to emphasize that this is AI restricted to sigma. So it's not just restricted, but also I'm throwing away A0 from the lot, because otherwise this would not be independent, right? But this is true because A0 does not appear here. So I call this package E or pi as well. It is the electric field, in fact. So if you, from electromagnetism, this would be just the electric field. So I call it, which I call the electric field. EI. And of course, there is an alpha index, the Lie algebra index. I don't want to get into those. So more covariantly, I can go back to this formula and say more covariantly define E as the pullback to sigma of star F. So you don't have to really, if you're not comfortable with these kind of formulas, it's okay. You can think of these in those terms. If you like geometry, then this is a more invariant way of thinking about this. So this would be a top minus one form on sigma valued in SU2. Okay, so this is just to say that by looking at these, I can actually avoid going into a component discussion of what is going on. I just can do this more invariantly. And notice that,
the whole star F is a two-index object, and E is just a one-index object. Are we taking some contract?
Oh, because I'm pulling, so this is, you're right. So this is a two-index object because this is 3 minus 1 is 2. The point is that on I kind of can always play this trick. So this is two indices down, and this is one index up, the one that I defined before. So the trick, in fact, is to use an epsilon to translate between one and the other.
So the E on the left-hand side of that pullback equation is the EJK or something like that.
Yeah, this one is this one, and that one is this one. But they are the same. And if you go in higher dimensions, you would have more indices here, more things there, and always one index up there.
We contact it like this, or we take the whole hot star of E, something like that. In Minkowski case, probably this is.
Well, there are lots of ways to. It depends on what's best for your computation. It's not a very deep point that one has to be particularly attached to. You can do what is most common. Okay, so. You see here, this is kind of the Legendre transform kind of thing, where you go from velocities to momenta, but only at a fixed time. And here is the same thing, except that for Yang-Mills, it's more complicated. So this gives us immediately the off-shell version of phase space. And now we will see why this cannot be the right final answer. So the off-shell for Yang-Mills is given by the following. So this is the set of V and A's, little a's. It's a bit unfortunate. Yeah, anyway. E and little a's, where A, I are one form on sigma valued in my algebra, whatever, and E, in fact, are top minus one form on sigma valued in the algebra. You see, they have complementary grading so that when I write sigma, I can actually write it like this. Or if I want to dualize, I can also think of these as vector fields, density valued, sorry, no, not density valued, a vector field of density weight 1. So here I think of E as square root of H. If you want F0i. So this is a vector field evaluated at sigma. but with a density in front. So it's kind of this is the same game that I was playing before. You can think of these in the two ways. But now, so we look, it seems that we're happy with this result to the extent that this is the usual phase space of Young-Mills theory, because we have a connection and or electromagnetism. No, we have a Maxwell potential, an electromagnetic potential A, and the electric field. So this looks the usual thing, but why is not good enough? Question. Is there a correspondence between P of and the space of on-shell solutions? In fact, here I mean a one-to-one correspondence, or what kind of correspondence? Well, it turns out that for sure, by restricting any solution, we will find a point in this space, but the other way around is not true. So the answer in this case is that F is contained but different from P. Well, where by contain, like I should say, the restriction map to sigma gives me an injective but not surjective the injective piece is not really right, but gives you a map, let's say gives you a map from F to P of, which is not surjective. And now we will see why. So the reason are the presence of these constraints. So we have to go back to Noether theorem. Recall that Noether 2 told us that J sigma of Xi is of the following form. C sigma alpha Xi alpha plus D of something. And that DC vanishes on shell. So, and then we had this formula here, omega sigma equal to this without any extra terms, in fact, and but we can use the restriction map to go to write these in terms of E and little a. This becomes here we use that there is no boundary, and we restrict sigma. We find what? We find that this is just the constraint. So it's the integral of my constraint, which actually is zero. So in particular, this tells me that on shell, this is zero on shell. On shell, omega f is degenerate. There are some direction that if you contract them with it, they give zero. And this constraint, in our case, is D is the divergence of E. Oh, you don't see it, sorry. Let me write it here then. C, in this case, is the divergence of E. So here I could write, so let me write it properly, actually, minus E integral. Probably there's no minus if I write it, because I'm integrated by part, trace of xi dE. So we see right away that there are two things happening. One is that I'm imposing the constraint to go on shell. And so that's why here I have too many things, because there are also those that do not satisfy, those configurations that do not satisfy the constraint. And the other thing is, if I impose the constraint, then my omega f has a kernel, which is precisely in the gauge direction. So next time we will see how to solve these two problems together. In fact, we have already seen it in the tutorial about the parameterized particle. We saw that once we went on shell of the constraint, so on this surface C, what happened is that our symplectic form was degenerate, and was degenerate precisely along the orbit. So we had to find a cut, and on that cut, we could define a symplectic structure. Here is the same thing. We have our gauge directions. Along those directions, our symplectic structure is degenerate on shell. And so when if we want to take care of that, we have at the same time to impose the constraint, which is what we are doing, and mod out the gauge. And this gives us back something that is non-degenerate. So this procedure is called symplectic reduction. I will not go into the details of the how to define that, but this is the point that I want to stress is that in the presence of local symmetries, this off-shell construction does not give you what I've always called the phase space, which is this space of on-shell histories. There is a mismatch. And the mismatch is due to the combination of two things, gauge and the constraint, which go hand in hand. They are so to give one last piece of one last idea that helps understand why these two must be related is the following. Remember, phase spaces are even dimensional, because for every p there is a q. And if I'm imposing a constraint, I'm killing a certain number of degrees of freedom. But this might make my phase space odd dimensional. I mean, here everything is infinite dimensional, but point by point, in SU2, I'm removing three directions. So it will make it odd dimensional. So the only way out is to remove as many, in fact. So that's why the two things go hand in hand. In a sense, the gauge directions are those conjugate to the constraint. And so if you remove one, you have to remove the other.
Just one more question. Because we started off by saying we were going from the covariant to the canonical phase space.
Yes.
And now we were always comparing off-shell and on-shell. So is the big picture that we went from covariant to canonical phase space in order to be able to compare those two, or?
Okay. Thanks. Yeah, maybe I should have added one step. So here we have the covariant phase space is not it's not clear whether one means the on-shell one that I wrote there or the off-shell version, where one takes all field configurations, not caring about the equations of motion. And on those, one looks at omega, big omega. You can do that. In fact, we have done it many times without, if you don't go on shell, if you don't impose the equations of motion to hold, then you're working in the covariant phase space off shell. So what we did here was to use that and go to the boundary to define the off shell phase space. And then we are we we are like, oh, but wait a second, the actual thing that matters for physics is really the on-shell phase space, like the space of solutions, not really all possible things. And then we find that in some cases, in the easy ones, once you go to the boundary, it doesn't really matter where what covariant phase space you use, whether the one off-shell or on-shell, for the scalar field, you get the same result. It's a bit of a, I mean, it's the way it works. But if there are local symmetries, then Noether-Second theorem tells you that that's not the case because you have constraints. So the restriction of your field to the boundary to be able, so the other way around, let me say it the other way around. So here, if you want E and A to be the initial data of a solution, so to be able to evolve those using Young-Mills equation of motion, then you need to impose the Gauss constraint. Otherwise, it cannot be an initial datum for your dynamics. So there is this mismatch, all possible electric fields without any constraints, they cannot be initial data for your equations of motion. So if you want that correspondence, you have to feed it in. Does it help?
I think I'm just not quite sure what to understand as the canonical phase space. No.
Okay. So by canonical phase space, in the easiest case, it's just P delta P delta phi. Like in Young-Mills, there are two notions, which there is not one unique notion. There are two, one on-shell and one off-shell. The off-shell is easy to describe, but not completely physical. The on-shell one, it's harder to describe because you have to do all these extra steps. But it's the one that's directly relates to your actual solution space. So there's not just one concept of canonical phase space for a gauge theory. There are I would say two, and both are useful. In fact, it's easier to quantize the off-shell one and then impose the constraint quantum mechanically, for example, than trying to quantize directly the on-shell one. Because, in fact, it's an on-local space. These fields satisfy equations that couple different points on your slice. So that's why it's so complicated, the on-shell space, because it has non-local properties, whereas this one is what you would call so this is easier to work with, but it's not quite the end of the story. And that's the entire difficulty of dealing with gauge theory. Usually it is presented that, oh, you have gauge symmetries and you have to mod them out, and that's the difficulty. But in fact, the actual source of all the troubles are the constraints. And those are physical, really, because this E is not something that cannot be measured. E, you can measure it, and then E has these properties. And gauge is just a way to describe these theories in a local manner.
The way I'm picturing this too is, you know, we're starting off with covariant phase space, we're making it bigger, and then we're trying to go back down again.
In a sense, and the reason why we went bigger, real, is because we want to work with local objects.
So
instead of these
local, and then we made it smaller to make it physical.
Yeah. And that this is something that you cannot escape when you work with the gauge theory. You have a trade-off, either local and non-physical, or non-local and physical. And that's something, yeah, that's the whole point of the whole crux of the matter in gauge theory is exactly this tension. Yeah, so it was a good question. Yeah.
So your point about constraints means that even if I say wanted to in electromagnetism just work with E and B, I still have difficulties because those are constrained.
So E and B are local, they are gauge invariant, but they do satisfy constraints. So not any E is a good initial datum. It must satisfy an equation that is, in fact, is a Laplace, like, can be written. Yeah, it's a non-local thing. And moreover, in that case, you would see that if you want to write the symplectic structure between E and B, there is an inverse derivative because B is the derivative of A. So if you want to write A in terms of B, you need some integral operator. So you would even have, in that case, a non-local symplectic structure. Like non-local, yeah, there is a Green's function essentially in between the two. So in that case, it's very clear that if you want to insist on local and physical, you need to give up locality because you need to invert the curl that gives you B from A.
So, but why did we say that from going from canonical covariant to canonical, we first increase the phase space?
I think what Charlie meant was start if we. By covariant, we mean the space of von Schell's of solutions of the equations of motion. So we need to enlarge first. We need to start with the off-shell covariant. So all possible configurations without any restrictions, and so on.